This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on Thursday, July 12, 2007. Should you have questions after listening to this recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Good morning. I'd like to call to order the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission for Thursday, July 12, 2007. The first item on our agenda this morning is the correctional approval of the minutes. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move approval of the minutes of an open meeting of the Federal Election Commission of Thursday, June 28, 2007, as set forth in Agenda Document 0746.
The Vice Chairman is so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, if you could record the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. The second item on our agenda involves draft advisory opinion 2007-08 involving Michael King. Again, Mr. Vice Chairman, it appears we have a late submitted document.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move suspension of our rules concerning the timely submission of documents so that we may consider agenda document 0750.
Vice Chairman is so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, if you could record the Vice Chairman's motion, it's been adopted by a vote of 5-0. On the advisory opinion, we have Richard Yule and Amy Rothstein from the General Counsel's Office. Richard Yule, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The draft before you in Agenda Document 07-50 is a response to a request for an advisory opinion from Michael King. Mr. King plans to donate personal funds to certain charities in honor of certain performances at campaign events. Mr. King would like to draw attention to the charities, and he would like to encourage greater volunteer participation in federal campaigns by musicians and other performers. Mr. King first asks whether he may make the donations, either directly or through a 501c3 foundation that he would establish to gather donations for the same purposes. The draft concludes that both Mr. King and the foundation may donate the funds to the charities as described in the request. The donations to charities would not be contributions because they would not provide any financial, tax, or other tangible benefit to the performers such that they would constitute compensation to the performers. The donations would not be expenditures under the Act and Commission regulations because their sole connection to federal elections would be to encourage volunteer activity, which is an activity that Congress has explicitly left unregulated. Finally, the draft concludes that Mr. King and the Foundation may publicize the donations through their own websites and that Mr. King may solicit federal candidate committees for donations to the charities. We'd be happy to address any questions.
Very good. Thank you very much. Any discussion? Commissioner Weintraub.
Mr. Chairman, I move approval of the draft.
Commissioner Weintraub has moved approval of Agenda Document 07-47. I'm sorry, I'm in the wrong document, 07-50. Any discussion on the motion?
Wait, 07-08, I think.
The advisory opinion is, it's advisory opinion 07-08. It's agenda document 07-50.
Got it.
Got it right the second time. Any discussion on Commissioner Weintraub's motion? Commissioner Walther?
I was having a problem with it because I felt that in this particular case, as I understand it, there's basically, to me, an impediment of an incentive to actually contribute services by the entertainer, the performer. So it seems to me like it's a true quid pro quo situation, there's not a situation where you just contribute money to a foundation and that money, gets used. But in here, it seems to me like the way I understand it, the actual performer would not be inclined to contribute his or her services without the money. And that seems to be the incentive to actually make that contribution. So to me, it seems a little more close than some of the others we've approved in more of a tangential way. So I'm not gonna support the opinion.
Okay. Commissioner Weintraub?
I just wanted to point out that in the context of, for example, PACs, that we allow corporations to make charitable contributions as an incentive to their employees to make contributions to the PAC, and that's money for money in a sense, and we allow that. And here we're talking about volunteer activity, which is an area that is more deregulated under the Act in general. So I think that I think the staff got it right. I think this is the right answer.
Well, I recognize it's a close question. To me, though, when you have somebody who is basically working with the candidate, selecting perhaps the kind of performance or where it's going to be, and you and Mr. King or whoever it might be and others would be selecting the performer, and then you give money directly to a foundation, there's a benefit that becomes a condition to that person's performance. And so it seems to me like there's a true direct quid pro quo that's almost negotiated, a little closer than some of the other examples. So that's why it just seems to me I can't quite go that far with this opinion.
Vice Chairman Mason, you would sought recognition?
If I shared Commissioner Walter's interpretation of this, I would have precisely the same objection. So just let me note that if there were, and it's notable to me that he used the term condition, in other words, if this were something approaching a contract where the performer would have an enforceable right to compel Mr. King or the charity to make a payment as a result of the performer's performance, then I would agree. And I had, in an earlier draft, suggested some language to try to sort of flesh out that point and the fact that, from my perspective, that's not what's going on here. And what we've stated at page 2 of the draft, line 15, is Mr. King or the foundation would select the recipient charities, determine the amount of each donation, and choose which performances to honor with donations, possibly with suggestions from the performers. And it's on that basis that I'm very comfortable approving this, and specifically on the condition that if the performer could select the charity, determine the amount of donation, and somehow enforce that, then we would obviously have a very different type of situation. But none of those factors are here. And so while I understand the theoretical concern, I don't think that concern is present in the facts that we've been given.
Okay. Commissioner Von Spakovsky, I believe you were also seeking recognition.
Well, I just want to – I understand Mr. Wallace's concern, but I want to point out that, I mean, we're not plowing new ground here. I mean, one of the sites we have here is for – an advisory opinion from 1982, I mean, 25 years old, in which, under an even more direct connection, we said that an honorarium is not accepted by a federal office holder, that office holder makes a suggestion that the honorarium be given instead to a charitable organization. And this is, you know, when they're coming to be a speaker at an event. And I don't see this as being that much different from that, and I think we're just following prior precedent rulings of the commission.
Okay. Further discussion?
Just follow up on that. It seems to me, though, in this particular case where we have a situation where if the person really wanted to be a contributor, there wouldn't be any need to give money to the charity. The entertainer would be there doing it regardless. And I think, of course, Mr. King or whoever it is will get a charitable deduction, and there's benefits to everybody coming going around. But I think the underlying consideration here is the fact that money's being paid. And I recognize the way it's being phrased, but I think in real life it's going to be, when you have such an active donor in terms of organizing an event and working with them and soliciting the performer and everything, it's really not quite the same. It's just one step of involvement that makes me pull back a little bit on this one. But no, I understand the position of everyone else on this, too. It's a close case.
Yeah, no, and I agree. I mean, from my perspective, I mean, I think the thing that you just touched on, an important distinction for me, which is the activity that is being encouraged here, is volunteer activity and not contributions or expenditures. But obviously this is a close case, and that's why they sought our advice, and that's why we have this process in place. Other discussion? Hearing none, all in favor of Commissioner Weintraub's motion, indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
Nay.
Madam Secretary, if you could record that Commissioner Weintraub's motion has been adopted by a vote of 4-1 with Commissioner Walther dissenting. Thank you, Mr. Yule. The next item on our agenda is the draft notice of proposed rulemakings on the use of campaign funds for donations to non-federal candidates and any other lawful purpose. We have Stacy Shin and Amy Rothstein from the General Counsel's Office. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Commissioners. Agenda document 07-47 is a draft notice of proposed rulemaking on the permissible uses of campaign funds by individuals to support their activities as federal office holders. The proposed rule would add to the current list of permissible uses of campaign funds and commission regulations donations to non-federal candidates subject to the provisions of state law and any other lawful purpose other than permissible use, personal use. This revision would update the commission regulations to reflect statutory changes to the act made by the Consolidated Appropriations Act. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, and the Vice Chairman has helpfully pointed out that we have the, a late submitted agenda document here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move suspension of our rules concerning the timely submission of documents so that we may consider agenda document 0747.
Thank you. The Vice Chairman is so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, the Vice Chairman's motion is carried by a vote of 5-0. Discussion on the document? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this one is about as straightforward and simple a rulemaking as we're likely to see, perhaps as we've seen in my tenure here and as we're likely to see in the near future. Congress made a change in the statute. We're conforming our regulations to the statutory change, and we're pretty much taking the language exactly out of the statute. So I'm hoping that this is going to be a really non-controversial rulemaking, and I thank the staff for their efforts, and I'm pleased to move approval of the document.
Very good. Commissioner Weintraub is so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, Commissioner Weintraub's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. Ms. Shin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Rosie Smith, thank you for shepherding these through today. The next item on our agenda is a report of the Audit Division on the Demint for Senate Committee. And we have Alex Bonowitz and Joe Stoltz and Teshvai Ashmamal from the Staff Director's Office from the Audit Division. And I don't, we're contemporaries in this on our documents. Yes, yes. Very good. I'm sorry, Mr. Bonowitz, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Commissioners. The report of the Audit Division on Demint for Senate Committee, Inc. presents five findings. The issues in findings 1, 3, 4, and 5 are relatively straightforward. My comments on the report will be with respect to the second finding, failure to file 48-hour notices. The committee did not file 48-hour notices for 84 contributions totaling about $175,000 prior to the primary runoff and general elections. In response to the interim report recommendation, the committee argued that contributions totaling about $60,000 were received in the 2 days after the end of the primary election 48-hour notice period, after the beginning of the runoff election 48-hour notice period, and before the results of the primary were known to establish and that a runoff would be necessary. The candidate participated in both elections, and the committee contends that no 48-hour notices should be required until it was certain that the runoff election should occur. The report concludes that the notices were required. We are prepared to answer any questions you may have.
Very good. We have objections on this from both Vice Chairman Mason and Commissioner Von Spakovsky. Von Spakovsky. Vice Chairman Mason, would you like to begin?
Thank you. Do we know who the other candidates were in the primary?
I know one of the other candidates was Governor David Beasley. I don't know if there were others.
Well, presumably there were others because there was a runoff necessary, and if there had only been two, then the runoff would have been necessary.
That's probably correct. I don't have the names, though.
And as to the candidates who didn't make the runoff, were they required to file 48-hour reports during the period that we think the Demint Committee was required to file those reports?
I don't believe they would have been required to file the notices.
So how does anybody know?
Well, the candidates are put on notice early. The commission sent out the notice, I believe it was May 3rd. That
no,
should
but all three candidates or four, or however many, received the same notice.
I believe so. It's
so
an
the notice wouldn't tell which needed to file and which didn't need to file.
No, just inform them of if a runoff was necessary, the dates for filing runoff reports and the 48-hour notices.
So it was conditional if a runoff was necessary.
Correct.
When were the candidates aware whether that condition was fulfilled or triggered?
Although the election was not certified officially till the 12th, I suspect they would have known either late the night of the primary or certainly the following morning, June 9th.
And yet we want them to file reports running back to what date?
It would have been contributions received on June 7th and June 8th. Now, the bulk of the contributions were received on June 8th, about $52,000. And those notices would have been required to be filed by June 10th.
So the campaign didn't have official notice until June the 12th, and they couldn't have had actual notice before sometime at the night of June the 8th.
Correct.
And despite that, contributions coming in on June 7th and 8th should have been reported.
That is the position we're taking, yes.
I'm afraid I disagree. When we have reporting requirements that relate to a runoff election, and it is not yet determined whether the election is even going to be held, much less which candidates will be in it, I don't think we can project back reporting requirements. I don't know what the facts are as to the period between the 9th and the 12th, and I think there even would be presumably some question about that because, you know, until the thing's certified, I don't know, but certainly, at least for my part, I don't see how we can establish a reporting requirement for an election that doesn't exist and may never be held. And I don't know, you know, in this case, I sort of vaguely remember the primary and, of course, the ex-governor, and I believe Senator DeMint was a member of the House, and it may well have been a factual situation where the two of them were clearly the leaders, but probably not a situation. Well, I would not want to get into a situation where the answer depended on what the polls looked like,
exactly.
You know, and that if we had two candidates at 40% and one candidate at 20%, the candidates at 40% by virtue of the polls, you know, had to start filing these. I think we need a hard and fast date, or we need a date certainly no sooner than the date of the primary, and the primary needs to be over before the runoff filing requirements can go into effect.
Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Well, my objection, Mr. Chairman, is along the same lines. We cannot impose a legal requirement on a candidate based on unofficial election results. You know, I used to do this when I was a county election official, and we always were very careful to tell candidates that what they saw on election evening, those were unofficial results. You know, those weren't the official results of the election until the election board had met, had looked at any claims that anyone made about the election, the possibility of a recount, all of the other factors that under state election laws can come up and can bring into question the final results of an election. And until the election results were certified, which in this case was June 12th, 4 days after the primary, DeMint did not have, in my opinion, any official responsibility to meet our requirements, because until those results were certified, there was no official runoff that was going to occur. That's the date that any responsibility for compliance with our laws would have come into effect.
Okay. Vice Chairman Mason?
I don't necessarily disagree with Commissioner Von Spakovsky, but I just want to make the point and get the understanding. We don't have to go that far in terms of any difference between official and unofficial results and certification dates in this case because the audit finding, as I understand it, applies to June 7th and June 8th. Is that correct?
The only items the committee is contesting, correct, apply to June 7th and June 8th. They didn't comment on the rest of the notices that weren't filed.
Okay. Ms. Bonos, Mr. Stoltz, any commissioners' thoughts on any of this?
I agree that this is a close issue, and you know, we also consulted with our colleagues in RAD and OGC and came down on this side of it. Naturally, if the commission decides otherwise, we'll be happy to make the adjustment.
Okay. Vice Chairman Mason?
I can understand the different legal arguments here, but just let me express my distress that one of the things that we have to do here all the time is try to make the statute work and to arrange these often complex and sometimes somewhat contradictory provisions of the statute in a way that we can enforce them and people can comply and so on like that. And this just is a case to me that frankly isn't a close call. And that's what bothers me about, you know, we just get this run up here and there's a very wooden application of the statute and that is what's presented to us. And while I know it's, you know, sometimes can be a problem for the staff either way, sometimes you'll come up with things that recommend a little flexibility and we'll say no, for what it's worth, at least in my view in this case, it wasn't a close call. And it didn't come up presented as a close call. It just came up as, well, this is what the statute requires, and that's what they had to do.
Okay. Other thoughts? I mean, from my perspective, I can understand how the staff reached this conclusion, but I believe that the vice chairman's approach is more reasonable. So I would be supportive of his suggestions on this matter. Commissioner Walther?
Yeah, my view on that was not exactly as I meant to state it. I agree, by the way. I wanted to approve the audit report, and I think in my notes I said we should, if we're going to put somebody in the future to the task of filing it, I think the notice could be more clear about that, you know, if you're involved in a runoff or reasonably believe, or I'm not too sure what the best phraseology is, but I think a notice could do a better job in the future maybe to alert somebody. But in this case, I just didn't think we should hold them to the requirement. So I agree with the comments of everybody so far.
Okay. Other thoughts, comments, suggestions, motions? Vice Chairman Mason?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the audit report be approved, except that finding 2 be revised to conclude that the campaign was not obligated to file 48-hour notices prior to the point at which a runoff election was established as required.
Okay, very good. The vice chairman has so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none. I'm sorry. Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
I just want to be clear that the effect of that will be to take out, Mr. Stoltz, the $59,500 listed as having been received on June 7th and 8th, correct?
Correct. Does the vice chairman's motion go further and to the 12th?
I wasn't trying to put too fine a point on it.
But Mr. Stoltz needs to know.
Okay. Are my colleagues ready to address that point? They are. No, they're not.
I like your first motion.
Okay. The Vice Chairman's motion stands as stated. Further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, if you could record the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. Mr. Bonowitz, Ms. Stoltz, thank you very much. The next item on our agenda involves a report of the Audit Division on Ted Pope for Congress. Sorry for that. The next item on our agenda is a report of the Audit Division on Ted Pope for Congress. We have agenda document 07-48 before us, and we have Martin Favin, Joe Stoltz, Terrence O'Brien from the Audit Division of the Staff Director's Office with us this morning. I'm sorry? That's right. We also have a... I'm going to take a short 5-minute recess to sort through the procedural matters on a document that I was just handed. I'm going to take a short recess. Thank you. We do have a late submitted document, and at this point I've forgotten whether the Vice Chairman has moved its admission or not. I believe he has not. But
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry. It's occurred. I've just been pointing out that the secretary is missing. So, while somebody may be taping this in the audience on the press table, our formal secretary is not here. So, we are going to rewind and start all over again, unless the podcast is live, and then those people who listen to this while exercising will be bemused by the reality of all of this. I want to apologize for our secretary. I leapt out of the starting box again, having resolved my own struggles with what on earth to do now. I had not waited. So I am reconvening the meeting, committee, the open meeting of Thursday, July 12th, 2007. We are on the matter of the report of the Audit Division on Ted Pope for Congress. I had recessed briefly because we have received two ex parte communications from counsel for Mr. Pope, yesterday, which has been placed on our website, went up on our website yesterday, I believe. There was subsequently a late submitted document from the staff that also, I believe, went up on our website yesterday, and this morning we received an additional ex parte communication from counsel for Mr. Pope responding to the late submitted document from the staff, and that matter has both, I think, is in the process of being put on our website and has also been made available in the outside of the hearing room for the public who was in attendance today to obtain if they would like that as well. My understanding from counsel and those more learned in the procedures of the agency than I, that we do not need a formal motion to introduce these documents, that they are on the record formally, but my recollection is we have a late submitted document from the staff which we need a formal motion to put on the record, and so I turn now to the Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move suspension of our rules concerning the timely submission of documents so that we may consider a memorandum from the Acting Chief Compliance Officer set forth as Agenda Document 0748A.
The Vice Chairman is so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, if you could record the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. We now move on to our discussion of the substance of all of this. We have Martin Favin, Joe Stoltz, and Terrence O'Brien from the Staff Director's Office, our Audit Division. Mr. Favin, please proceed.
Okay. There were four findings in this final audit report. Three of them were disclosure issues that were materially corrected in response to the interim audit report. The third finding is documentation for receipts, which I will talk about a little bit because it seems to be an interesting finding. And there was we did a review of receipts, contributions and there was a 19% error rate for record keeping as far as the committee having copies of checks or digital images available to us during the audit. And this matter was presented to the committee at various stages of the process during field work at the EXA conference and, of course, in the interim audit report. And in response to the interim audit report, the committee basically said that the copies of the checks and the digital images were available at the bank. However, other than a sample of a few of the contribution checks, the items that were provided to us didn't decrease the error rate from this review. And so that's where we are on that matter at this point.
Thank you. Commissioner Von Spakovsky, you are the objector on this matter.
Did we provide the committee with a list of the checks that we wanted to see?
Well, we weren't able to do that because it was a sample review. So we weren't able to give them a list of the actual errors from our review. However, at the beginning of the inventory of the field work, we did give them a general list of some of the missing deposit records that we needed, which I think if they had provided those, we probably would have had a much lower error rate in this area. But no, the actual list of errors was not provided.
I guess I'm a little confused. I'm not sure how we can do a finding saying they're not providing us with copies of the checks if we're not telling them which checks we want them to provide. Because, I mean, first of all, I mean, to me, it's very clear that under our regulation, the committee doesn't have to keep the checks themselves. There's nothing wrong with them having their bank keep the checks as long as they have access to them and can provide us with those copies whenever possible. In fact, I mean, I think our regulation was put in place a long time ago before banks changed their normal procedure, which these days is you don't get your checks unless you specifically ask for them. The banks keep digital copies of them. So, you know, in my view, they are fully within the regulation when the bank is keeping copies of the checks for them as long as they have access to them. But I guess I don't quite understand why we would have a citing against them if we haven't sent them a list of the checks we want to see so they can get them from their bank and provide them to us.
Well, I think the response to that is that, you know, when we do a review, we either do a sample or we do a 100% review, which means we look at everything. If we had looked at all the items, we could have given them a list of the ones that were missing. But the sample is kind of reflective of the whole universe of checks. And if we can't give them the actual errors in that case because then they would just provide the ones that were missing from the sample review. In other words, we're just looking at a small portion of the whole universe. And that's why we can't give them the actual errors from the review when we do a sample review. So basically what we tell the committee to do is to find the missing items, provide them to us for our review, and then we look and see if they've corrected the errors from the sample.
Vice Chairman Mason.
Well, I have to agree. I'm mystified. First, I think the auditors are in agreement that if the bank has digital images of these checks, that satisfies the regulation as far as retention. Is that correct? Is there any dispute about that?
Mr. Stoltz.
If, in fact, they are produced when we ask for them.
Well, that's the second part. We
that's
have a retention
part
and a production part. But so we're all in agreement on the retention part, that if the bank's got them,
The bank almost certainly has them.
And they've retained them. And so then the second element of the regulation is they have to be produced at no cost to the commission. And so my question is, when we go through and do this audit finding, what did we ask the committee to produce? And if, well, I'll just leave. And Mr. Favin gave an answer that makes me very sympathetic to the committee, which is, well, the committee has to guess what we want them to produce. And so if our position is that we do a sample because sample's easier on us and it's easier on the committee. And by the way, it's, you know, going to be entirely sufficiently accurate for purposes of the audit. That we do a sample for all those valid purposes, but if the sample discovers errors, the committee has to produce 100% of the checks, or maybe they guessed wrong, then we ought to say that. I'm not sure I think that ought to be the standard, but we ought to say that. But we certainly can't say, well, you know, we've got errors here. We can't tell you where the errors are, but you need to produce some unspecified records to resolve the errors that we haven't told you about. What, you see what I'm saying? What the problem of the committee, and do we, you know, what do we think is the solution to that? In other words, how would a committee be assured in the face of a preliminary finding of this sort that it was responsive?
When we do a sample test, whether it be on the receipt side, the disbursement side, we're generally checking for a number of things. And we use that sample to evaluate all of them. If, for example, we decide that, or we discover that there are quite a few contributions that should have been itemized and they weren't, just for an example. We'll do that on a sample basis. We'll tell the committee, all right, this is, you know, our test shows that 15%, 20%, whatever it turns out to be, of the contributions that required itemization were not. Now, we do not then give them, and here are the sample items for you to fix, because what we want them to fix is the entire filing, not just the sample items. And so we then use that same sample to evaluate the corrective action. And the committee is responsible for determining where their filings are inadequate. And the same is done here. When we say there are records missing, we went through the deposits, there are quite a few deposits that there are no copies of. If you want to get them from the bank, fine, you can get them from the bank, but produce them, and we'll use our same sample to then evaluate whether the production was adequate.
But as to incorrect reporting, I can understand, but that's where my question was going. As to records, it seems like the only satisfactory answer is 100% production.
I think that's correct, yes.
And so the position then is that when we do a sample and we find that some of the records are not at the audit site, not available to the auditors, despite our conclusion that they are, I think your words were, almost certain to be available at the bank, that we want them produced for no other reason than that we want them produced. There's no other substantive. We don't think there's a reporting error here. There's no other substantive violation underlying it. We just want them produced.
Except that these records are also what we base our judgment of a lot of the other violations or potential violations on. You know, a lot of this has, you know, this tells us, allows us to verify the name of the contributor. It allows us generally to verify, you know, address information, attribution information, based on the checks.
I guess I'm sorry, Commissioner Walther.
I've got a question. I know in nowadays you can just go on your own account and look up the check. And I'm just wondering if they just said, here's our password, go take a gander at it, and you could scroll through and pick out the check you want and make a copy of it and that kind of thing. Would that be something that would interfere with your normal process?
No, but I don't know that that would work in this particular situation. That's certainly true with checks that you write. These are checks that the committee deposited, and typically those are not as easily accessed online.
Commissioner Weintraub.
So how would this... Historically, you know, before the days of banks storing all this stuff electronically, you know, let's say we're back in the paper and pencil world. So you would go out to the field to do the field audit, and you would take sit there with all of the boxes? You would have 100% and then you'd choose a sample? Is that the way it would work?
That's generally the way it's worked. Or some people keep them digitally as well. And there'll be CDs, and you load the CDs up and they're on the CDs. That's becoming more common.
So do you normally ask for access to 100% of the records?
Yes.
Did you in this case?
Yes, and they had about 80% of them on site.
Okay, so you asked them for 100% of the records, and they said they wouldn't give them to you, or?
It's not they wouldn't give them. They were incomplete. And we went through them. You know, here are the records. We went through the records, and we concluded that almost 20%, 19% were missing.
And their position is that they're not missing, they're at the bank.
That's correct.
And if I can follow up, and the stumbling block seems to be that we have not conveyed to them clearly what exactly the 20% constitutes, which specific records are missing?
We are unable to give them a list of the 20% because the sample doesn't provide us a list of the 20%. We did not spend the time to inventory every deposit that they had against the bank statements to determine which ones were missing. We do have a partial list that came out of some other work we did, and we had provided that. But the point of the sample is not to have to go through this on a 100% basis.
If I can be clear, so we ourselves don't know the specific deposits that are missing from the records either.
We do not. We don't know all of them, no.
Do we know any of them? Can we
identify some of them?
We know some of them, and if
we've given them some listings of some of the ones that are missing.
And the ones that we have given them listings of, have they produced those records?
No.
Okay. And we gave this list to them recently, or at the during the field period. Okay, and have they articulated a reason why those particular records were not produced?
No.
Okay. Vice Chairman Mason.
Well, it's just getting back to how did they solve this, and I just want to underline that it sounds like the position is that because of the methodology involved here, the only way the campaign could resolve this is to get 100% of the deposited items from the bank to cure a 19% error rate. And that is going to involve a considerable expense.
Well, of course, the committee knows or can determine which ones they have. And so they would be then having the bank produce the remainder.
So in that case, they have to go through either the expense of having the bank produce everything, which would probably be simpler but cost a lot, or they have to retain somebody to go through and do the 100% records check that we didn't think was necessary as an initial screening device to determine where there are deposits that they don't have copies of the items in-house and then request those specific items from the bank.
We didn't consider it necessary to reach a conclusion about the completeness of the records. Obviously, if our finding had to have underlying it 100% check, then we would have gone through and done it. But that's the point of using sampling in these things, to avoid having the commission do the 100% check.
Well, I understand that, but my question is as to the remedy here. The only remedy is for the campaign to do 100% check or 100% production.
Yes, that's what they would need to do in order to determine which portion of the records are missing and to get them produced.
And the purpose of that is what?
It allows us to evaluate their compliance with both disclosure and various other requirements with respect to contributions.
And as to the 81% of the records that were present, did we come up with any substantial compliance issues?
The only other contribution issue that arose had to do with occupation, name of employer.
And that was also on a sample basis?
Yes.
And so the additional 19% of the checks are unlikely to shed any additional light on that.
They were able to correct, obtain that information and correct it.
So they fixed that?
They fixed that.
They don't need the 19% of the checks to fix that?
They did not.
Okay. So the only reason at this point we want them to produce the additional 19% of the checks is to show that they can produce them?
We want them to produce them to complete the record. And you know, if that is the way we want to phrase it, then I suggest that yes, that's they're required to make these records available. They have not done it. It does impact on our ability to test other things.
Well, but that's why I was asking.
We made the judgment in this case that the risk of there being other sorts of noncompliance is low.
Well, that's why I was asking that question. In other words, it would obviously be a different situation if there were a lot more checks missing, or if the checks that were present had errors that led you to believe there were bigger problems there. But it just seems to me that the proposed alternative remedies, either of which are going to be very expensive and very time consuming for the committee that's audited here, are way out of kilter to the violation, and that there is no substantive purpose that I can discern in forcing the committee to produce records that we're pretty certain that they have. And so I don't want to be out forcing the committee to produce paper or electronic images just to produce them. And it sounds to me like that's almost where we are.
Commissioner Walther.
I have a question. You said that 80% of the checks were available to you?
Yes.
How are they available? Were there tangible checks that they kept and made copies of, and then there were some that they didn't make copies of, so they just figured the bank had them?
I believe they were paper copies.
Yes, they were paper.
That were at committee headquarters.
Checks received that they made a copy of the front and back of them?
Committees commonly do that.
I assume that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if you don't have a bank that does this for you, then the committee then just makes copies of all the checks, fronts and backs, and hangs on to them until the bank's retention rate expired.
For decades, the banks have been able to do this. As I understand it, it's a requirement of banking law that they be able to do this.
Yes.
I don't know that we have ever had a situation where somebody contends that the bank is our record-keeping agent. Mm-hmm. And because they can produce them, we have the records and are in compliance.
Well, I think that's my concern, is that I think maybe today isn't the day to solve the larger problem of what do you do in the future, because we're kind of directing our discussion to the 19% or 18% of the checks that aren't available. But I have some reluctance to just say, all right, the bank is automatically our agent, when we have no control over what the bank does, whether they keep them or not, they merge, they lose them, and they're not true an agent. Yes, they independently, for separate reasons, keep copies of those, and they're not always easy to find if they're not your own, the checks that you write, but they're the checks that come in, then that could be a substantial burden on somebody. But it doesn't seem to me it should be on the commission necessarily. So I'm just concerned about the long haul. What's the answer?
I mean, was that a question or?
Well, it is a question in the sense that I gather we all tend to think that in this particular case it's not a substantive situation, but in the long haul, maybe this is a discussion for another day. What's the best approach?
Mr. Stoltz.
Well, there will be, I'm sure, cases where we go in and there are very few of these records available otherwise. And we are in a situation where we simply can't reach any conclusions. It may not be this case, but will be cases that come up. And the bank, of course, will have this information. And you know, what do we do? Do we insist the committees obtain it from the bank? try to come up with some other approach.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to sort of, from my perspective, I mean, it doesn't particularly trouble me that the committee makes a decision that the bank will be the repository of the records. I mean, the liability, the legal risks lies with the committee as to who it selects to hold its records, and if it chooses an agency or an entity that performs that function poorly, be it a bank or a treasurer or some other person or entity, the liability lies with them. So that part of it doesn't concern me that much, and you know, they have an obligation when we come to audit them to produce records, and they have to comply with that sort of, and it doesn't particularly concern me that those records are off-site prior to that moment. The part that I'm sort of really having trouble getting my head around is that we have used a sampling methodology, which makes a ton of sense and I think advantages both the committees that we audit and ourselves. And as I understand it, we provide or seek a subset of their entire records on a sampling basis to try and test their record-keeping system, and that in this case the committee produced some but not all of those records. And what I understood you to say before, which I don't really completely grasp, is that at this point in history, we cannot identify for them the records they were not able to produce, and as a consequence, they cannot further pursue this matter with the bank. And that's the part of it that I just really have trouble understanding.
Well, we may not be able to provide an exhaustive list of every deposit that they made for which there are no copies on site, nor did we undertake.
But that's not my question was as to the sample.
Tried to do that. It doesn't mean that the committee cannot do that.
But no, my question really turned on the sample. I mean, how many items did we ask from them in the sample?
We wound up with around a little over 100, 115, something like
okay,
that.
Okay, so that roughly, for purpose of conversation, we asked for 100 records of 100 deposits, of contributions that were deposited, about 100 of them. So that's a fair sense of what the
yes.
sample looked like? Mm-hmm. And presumably we provided this, either we went through the records they had on site or we provided this list of records to them to produce copies of the, I assume, the underlying checks or credit card transactions that generated these contributions.
Yes, and the credit cards were an issue at first, but they were able to get a hold of the vendor who does their credit card processing and get the vendor to provide the necessary information for that. So those cleared up.
Okay. So this problem really lies in the context of people who made their contribution through check?
Yes.
Okay. And I assume that we provided them with, well, you can tell me, we either provided them with a list of the checks we were seeking, or we asked them to produce the records they had, and we looked through their records to see if the checks were there.
They produced the records they had, we looked through them to see what was there and what wasn't.
Okay, so based upon the list we had from the sample, we were able to check the records they had on site and discern that some of the checks were in their records and some were not.
Correct.
Okay. And so, and from this search, presumably the 19% number contributions for which we had not seen records is generated. That's where the 19% comes from.
That's where it comes from.
Okay. But we do, in fact, know the identities of the donors and presumably the dates of the donations of this 19%.
That we have, yes.
Okay. And have we produced that record to the committee?
No, we have not.
Okay. Is there a substantive reason not to give them that list?
At this point in the process, we could provide that list. We were holding that list so that we did not compromise our sample, so that we could then use it to evaluate their response to other findings.
If we gave them the list and they went to the bank and produced these checks, and the bank gave them copies of these checks, and then they delivered those checks to us, so we had in fact 100% compliance to discern whether these deposits actually came from people who were lawfully able to make contributions in the sums that they gave them. We now have records that reflect that these were appropriate transactions. How has that process, the giving them the list and having them produce these records for us, compromised our sample?
At this point, I don't know that it would compromise our sample with respect to this issue. It would have compromised the sample with respect to other issues we're evaluating with the same sample.
Such as?
for example, the occupation name of employer.
How does it? We were able to get the checks. We were able to identify that, in fact, they have the names of the particular people who made these contributions, the sums and the dates, and their records are complete. And as near as we can discern, they've complied to the law at that point. And then we want to test whether they've also, presumably, for those individuals who made contributions of a size that triggered further, reporting as to their identity and occupation on their reports, we would be able to test that. I assume.
We would be able to test other issues, whether it be excessive contribution, prohibited contribution, itemization, occupation, name of employer, accuracy and completeness of disclosure information.
Yeah.
All of these different things are all tested with the same sample.
The thing I'm struggling with is how does any of that work end up being compromised by the fact that the committee knows which 100 checks we were looking for?
Because we will then use that same sample when amended reports are filed to evaluate whether the amendments materially corrected the filings. In this case, we did have one other issue in that, and that was the occupation name employer. When the amendments were filed, we used the same sample to go back and look for the ones that our sample said were missing, along with all the others that they identified and corrected. And we concluded that they had done a reasonably good job of the correction using that same sample. If you give the entity being audited the list of that sample, you have destroyed the usefulness of that sample for evaluating response to the recommendation.
To the degree that that sample shows us that there were other kinds of violations, it would make it harder to ensure that whatever corrections they made for those other kinds of violations were systemic corrections rather than corrections of the particular problems we found. But as near as we can tell, we don't know right now whether there were any other violations that drew out of that 19% sample that we don't have right now.
No, we cannot be certain of that. Now, based on what we had seen, with the exception of the occupation name employer, we felt that it was unlikely.
So it seems unlikely that there would be further, that were we to provide them this list, they were to produce the records. The thing that we're protecting by not giving them this list is unlikely to be truly compromised in this particular case.
At this point in the process,
as we understand it. Okay.
Not necessarily so at the interim audit report stage when we're going to use that sample to evaluate their response.
Okay. That's enormously helpful in understanding what it is we're trying to protect. I guess the problem I'm trying to balance that against is we've really left at this stage of the proceedings the committee with an impossible task in the sense that they have, on our testing sample, failed to produce records, and we can't, because those records are held at the bank, and we're not conveying to them which records they need to produce, and therefore they can't, they in all likelihoods have those records, they just can't produce them because we won't tell them which ones they're missing. And really the only cure for this is for them to have the bank produce all records of the entire, I presume this is a two-year audit, of all deposits during that time frame.
They do have a record of the deposits that they have copies of, the 80%.
Right, but they've chosen not to retain copies of all of their records that they're
building.
Right, but building.
When you say that it's an impossible task, it is not an easy task. I give you that.
It's
fine. They know the deposits they made, and they know that they have records for 80% of them. The question is, is it their responsibility then to determine which 20% are not there and then obtain the 20%?
But there's no real way on earth they could discern what those 19% of missing records are out of our sample. As I understand it, all they could do is to have the bank produce every record of every deposit they made.
Every record of every deposit they made that they don't already have a copy.
That they don't already have, but they would have to have a complete set of all deposits available. That really is the only way they could get themselves out of this particular box.
And that, at the time we did the testing, that was the situation, yes.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Mr. Wilder, you had your hand. Let me just follow up because this question is related to this. And
the question I've got is why, as I understand it, we asked for records on 100 different items.
Well, we asked for the records. Our sample had 100, give or take.
Right.
100 or a little more items.
Okay. So there are 100 items, and 19% of them, we found this problem, right? So now,
correct.
So now you're worried that if they have the list of the 19%, then it compromises the list if we want to test other things. But we've got all these other records. Why can't we, when you want to test occupational issue, for example, why do you have to go back to the same sample? You've got all these other records. Why can't you just take a sample from a different set? A different set than the records on this particular issue, whose information we've turned over.
We could resample when we need to evaluate a response. That is a possibility. It is time consuming and difficult for us to do, and essentially has us redoing parts of the audit. So the policy has always been we hold this confidential and use it to evaluate a committee's efforts at correcting the problems that are identified, as opposed to redoing the sample later on.
Commissioner Weintraub.
But it sounds like what we're saying is we don't want to do something that's time-consuming and difficult, so we're going to make them do something that's time-consuming and difficult so that we don't have to do something that's time-consuming and difficult. And I'm not sure that's the appropriate response. Let me say overall, I'm very sympathetic to the objection, but I'm also a little bit uncomfortable about the process here because we had an objection and the audit staff, in response to the objection, at the last minute, put in a correction to their report or an amendment to their report. In response to which, something that I've never seen happen before, the lawyer for the audited committee was standing over our secretary at the meeting trying to hand in a really late submitted document. I don't know about you, Commissioner Mason, I've never seen that one before. I was tempted at the time to ask Mr. McGann to stop harassing our secretary, but I thought that when people look back at the transcript, they would come to an entirely erroneous conclusion about his conduct. But this to me is, I wonder, A, whether we shouldn't just hold this over and try and sort all this stuff out, because I don't like all this last-minute flurry of back and forth. It also raises for me an issue that has occurred to me numerous times in similar circumstances, usually in the context of AOs, that where we find ourselves, we're sitting at the table in an open session, and there are the auditors or sometimes the lawyers, and there's the lawyer sitting out there in the front row, and I'm, checking his facial expressions to try and see what his reaction is to what the auditors and the lawyers are saying, when it would be so much easier to invite him to say, stop that. he's bidding now at an auction. it would be so much simpler to invite him to just sit at the table as he did just yesterday and share his views on the subject. And I think it would be more illuminating for the commission when we find ourselves in this. So I will suggest again that we should investigate, and I don't know whether there's anything that bars us from doing this, just having a process by which when questions come up, either in the context of an audit or an AO, and we're sitting here at the table and the lawyer's in the room, that we ought to do just that. Invite him to come up to the table and tell us what his experience is, rather than have this last-minute, late-submitted ex parte communications that are trying to get entered into the record, which strikes me. And then we're trying to read them at the table, and it just doesn't seem like a very good way of doing business and coming to well-thought-through legal conclusions. So, I'm very, from what I've heard here, I'm very sympathetic to the objectors, the objections to this audit. I wouldn't mind holding it over to try and sort some of this stuff out, but I do think it would be enormously useful either, when this comes back to the table or in other matters, if we would provide that opportunity to provide ourselves that opportunity when we have the people sitting in the room to find out from them directly what their experience has been in this process.
Okay, Vice Chairman Mason.
I share some of Commissioner Weintraub's concerns about the process, and particularly as to advisory opinions. I think it makes a lot of sense. My only concern in the audit process is that one of the things we want to do, and this has come up more in the presidential audits than in the Title II audits, is we want to put an end date. You know, and what we don't want is to have an interim audit report that says do this or produce that or whatever, and they don't do it, and then the final audit report, and then they show up at the commission meeting saying, oh, we've got them now. So, I mean, if there's some factual issue or something like that, or some question about what, you know, factual question about what was done or asked or whatever, I think. So we may need to think about balancing that some. But I just want to go on the substance. It would be fine with me to hold it over and try to give it some more thought. But my concern is that in a lot of places in the audit process, we look at remedies that are fit for the violation. And we have thresholds, and so not everything has to be 100% to avoid a finding, for instance. And we have sampling. And in this particular audit, we had a scope expansion. You know, we went out and examined something, and we came back, and based on the initial examination, we decided to ask some more questions than we would have. And so it strikes me that I can fully understand there may be a situation where we go out and only half the records are available, and the half that are there show some substantial problems, in which case it may well be that the only remedy to getting a reasonable audit is to tell the campaign to go out and get 100% of the checks. But in the factual situation here, where the only thing left is just producing the records just to produce them, it strikes me that that is a pointless exercise. And so my suggestion isn't that we sort of wave it away and say, well, in every case, if the bank theoretically has them, the problem is taken care of, but rather that we think about what sort of remedy is fit in a particular situation, which we do all other places in the audit process, and not ask for a remedy or produce a finding that suggests the need for a remedy where there's really no purpose behind it. And that, as I understand it, is sort of where we are now. And I understand a different audit might produce a different result, but if all we're asking for at this point is to produce them to produce them, I don't see why that's important.
Yeah. I mean, from my perspective, my sense is that the problem lies a little further down the road, because I think why we're asking them to produce them is to see whether there are other sort of substantive violations, whether they were in corporate contributions or some in excess of the contribution limits or some other thing. That we're looking for more than simply can you produce the records, that the purpose is to ascertain the accuracy and propriety of the reports. The problem I'm having is that given the way we're approaching sampling, we're really creating a situation where, presuming a committee wants to have the banks retain the records, or any person or entity not have 100% of their records available when we arrive, they end up unable to comply with our production requests. And that doesn't entirely make sense to me. And I understand Mr. Stoltz's comments. Well, we want to the degree that these are samples and we find other kinds of violations they have to remedy, we want to make sure that the remedy is systemic rather than just to these particular matters. We have other tools in enforcement. If we reach above certain thresholds, the audit division refers it over to the general counsel's office, and we proceed accordingly, and maybe those are better or accurate remedies. I just have trouble accepting the notion that our sampling methodology results in a situation where the committees must have 100% of all records available, because we simply cannot tell them what 19 checks we're looking for. It just doesn't entirely make sense to me. So I'm willing to hold this over and try and sort through these things and come up with sort of a systemic solution. I think it was a helpful in that my sense is that there is a consensus that it is appropriate for committees to, allow banks to retain records so long as they can produce those records later. I'm not entirely clear to me that that's where everyone in the building began this process. I think that there's a somewhat smaller but real sort of question of how do we sort through this kind of problem. And I'm, on first blush, I mean, I'll be happy to think about it a little more. Don't see, you know, it seems to me on balance we should tell them what checks we're looking for, because at a minimum then we would be able to find out whether they have these records and have met at the core record-keeping requirement, which is what we're trying to find here. I'm willing to think through the implications of that or whether there are things downstream that produce, you know, outcomes that we don't like, and I'm perfectly willing to hold this over while we think through those things. But it seemed, in first instance, that we get far closer to achieving the goal we set out for in these audits, which is to find out whether they have the records and that reflect that the reports they filed with us are accurate by simply telling them what we're looking for. Other thoughts? Commissioner Walther.
Yeah, I have no objection to holding it over, and I think the point is we tend to want to make a decision based upon the facts before us, where we are seeing ourselves as holding up a audit process over 19 checks or something like that, and so we see it as a de minimis situation. But then I'm also concerned about the long run and how it would interfere with the audit process, which I don't fully understand, and the reasons for the process. So I agree it would be good to hold it over and try and get a better grip on what that would mean, what the impact would be if you just told somebody we need these 19 checks and how that would affect the credibility or thoroughness of the audit.
Okay. Comments, suggestions? Okay, Madam Secretary, if you could note that we will hold this matter over into the next open meeting of the Federal Election Commission. The last item on our agenda involves any management or administrative matters. Ms. Clark, do we have such matter items for us?
No, Mr. Chairman, we do not.
Okay, very good. With that, we bring the meeting to a close. Thank you.